This is God and Autobiography, the podcast, a dramatic adaptation of the book God and Autobiography as Told to a Philosopher by Jerry L. Martin. He was a lifelong agnostic, but one day he had an occasion to pray. To his vast surprise, God answered in words. Being a philosopher, he had a lot of questions, and God had a lot to tell him. Episode 32. He was to become the Buddha, the awakened or enlightened one. But he was born Siddhartha Gautama, a prince and member of the warrior class. In the oldest collection of Buddhist scriptures, the Pali Canon, he tells his story. I was tenderly cared for, supremely so, infinitely so. At my father's home, lotus pools were made for me. In one place for the blue lotus flowers, in one place for the white lotus flowers, and in one place for red lotus flowers, blossoming for my sake. Of Benares fabric were my three robes. Day and night, a white umbrella was held over me so that I might not be troubled by cold, heat, dust, chaff, or dew. I dwelt in three palaces, in one for the cold, in one for the summer, and in one for the rainy season. Eventually, the pampered Gautama ventured beyond the palace gates and was shocked by what he saw. An aged man with twisted body, another afflicted by illness, and finally, a corpse surrounded by mourners. He asked his driver to explain what he had seen and learned, to his horror, that we all are subject to age, illness, and death. And he, going to his rooms, sat brooding, sorrowful, and depressed, thinking, "Shame, then, verily, be upon this thing called birth, since to one born the decay of life shows itself like that." The next time Gautama went out, he saw a shaven-headed man, a recluse, wearing the yellow robe, and was told, "He is one who has gone forth." "What does that mean?" "To have gone forth, my lord, means being thorough in the religious life, thorough in the peaceful life, thorough in good actions, thorough in meritorious conduct, thorough in harmlessness, thorough in kindness to all creatures." The prince returned to his rooms and, there and then, cutting off his hair and donning the yellow robe, went forth from the house into the homeless state. In an intense effort to achieve spiritual illumination, he engaged in increasingly severe ascetic practices. "I determined to take food only in small amounts, as much as my hollowed palm would hold. My body became extremely lean. The mark of my seat was like a camel's footprint. The bones of my spine, when bent and straightened, were like a row of spindles. But by this severe mortification, I do not attain superhuman, truly noble knowledge and insight. Perhaps there is another way." In this frame of mind, Gautama came upon a delightful spot with a pleasant grove, and sat down under a sacred tree and meditated for days. Finally, enlightenment came. He promptly went to the holy city of Varanasi, Benares, and preached his first sermon, The Four Noble Truths, to five fellow ascetics. There are two ends not to be served, he explained. The pursuit of desires and of the pleasure that springs from desire, and the pursuit of pain and hardship. Avoiding both indulgence and extreme asceticism, he concluded, brings clear vision, it makes for wisdom, and leads to peace, insight, enlightenment, and nirvana, escape from the chains of existence. He preached the noble eightfold path, right views, right resolve, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. This is the middle way.
Buddha is a special case. Not so much a big revelation or development of myself, but more a perceptive distillation of one part of what it is to be human, of kindness. That is precious and delightful, but not a major spiritual step. It has given rise to more error than truth.
Perhaps the error is found not so much in Buddha as in later doctrines in the Buddhist tradition?
Yes.
India, like Israel, is a birthplace of religions. Abigail and I went to northern India to visit major sites of Hindu, Muslim, and Buddhist culture. Since these prayers began, I have found myself spiritually sensitive. As I travel, I sometimes stop in places of worship, either to pray or just to take a look. On one occasion, I was in downtown Seattle and stopped in at a mainline Protestant church. I don't remember the denomination. Almost immediately, I felt I was suffocating and raced to escape from the building. At the opposite extreme, I attended a bar mitzvah at a conservative Jewish temple. As soon as I stepped into the sanctuary, it was like coming in from the cold and being hit in the face by a wall of hot air. Except in this case, it was the dense presence of God, so palpable that I looked around, expecting others to be reeling as I was. But no, they were just chatting. As we visited the sacred sites of India, I expected my inner seismograph to be way up on the spiritual Richter scale. We saw Hindu temples with figures of Vishnu and other gods, a Muslim mosque as the men were gathering for prayer, evening rituals conducted by young Brahmins, funeral fires on the banks of the sacred river Ganges, the revered cows wandering in the middle of the traffic, even a holy man walking the streets naked. But my spiritual censors registered only once, at the place where Buddha gave his first sermon. We approached the monument marking the site amidst a crowd of devotees and tourists. We could hear the chants of Buddhist priests in the distance. We had not yet seen anything, just stepped onto the grounds, when the deepest sadness came over me. It was not my sadness, but the sadness of the enlightened one, as if he were feeling, "Oh no, no. They are coming here to worship me. I am not a god. This was not my message at all. I was a complete failure." His message was about suffering. According to the Buddhist scriptures, the enlightened one now understood the chain of causation that results in suffering. He saw that from the organs of sense comes contact. From contact comes feeling, from feeling craving, from craving clinging to existence, from clinging to existence the desire of becoming, from the desire of becoming rebirth, from rebirth old age and death, grief, lamentation, pain, sorrow, and despair. Such, he concluded, is the origin of the whole mass of suffering. That seemed extreme to me. Wasn't Buddha overreacting? Giving up all desire to avoid suffering seems like putting out your eyes to avoid ever seeing anything ugly.
Don't dismiss him on that account. There is wisdom here.
Is his reaction to suffering less central than it seems, or what?
The main theme is his compassion. It is not that he will grow old, get sick, and such, but he is a very sensitive soul who reacts very strongly to and feels the suffering of others.
But we suffer, and you suffer, for a reason, don't we?
Yes, but the first step is to fully acknowledge the horror of suffering, not just to dismiss it as shit happens or transmute it into growth. Suffering is the pits. It has all the evil that those who turn against God on account of it believe it has.
As Buddha's story goes on, death is described as permanent separation from family. But if there is reincarnation, that is not the real story of death, is it, Lord?
In a sense, it is. Something goes on and is reincarnated, but it is not Fred and Jane. Death is final in that respect. So the loss of death is ultimate.
As I read more, I could see Buddha's virtues. Lord, Buddha is impressive for his boundless compassion as well as his reasonableness and moderation.
Buddha was an extraordinary person. There was such sensitivity to his nature, no membrane, no filter, that he felt the sufferings of others to an extraordinary extent. He almost literally felt their pain, sometimes more than they did in the midst of their own deflections. It is not so much that he listened to me, hence there is no God in his preaching, as that I was present in and permeated his sensorium, his sensitivity to others. That is how I relate to human suffering, as does Jesus. I both hold my own suffering, disappointments, anger, and so forth, but also everyone else's. Buddha was like that with regard to those with whom he came into contact.
But isn't Buddha's message very limited?
All messages are limited. There's nothing wrong with his message. It is the pure truth on those things he spoke about.
But Buddha sees life only as a trail of tears. He doesn't seem to appreciate the joy of existence, the gift of life.
Yes and no. You've had a good life so far. Many have not. Nothing guarantees that your life will continue to be good. Look at most people in human history. Don't cover up the horror of death or the burden of life.
So your communication with Buddha was successful?
Yes, this was the only case of pure, total communication. Culture did not interfere since Hindu culture is an appropriate context for these revelations.
Does Buddha eclipse the Vedic tradition?
Of course not.
Life is a wonderful gift. Isn't it a mistake to want to escape rebirth?
No, not in the way he meant it. Birth really means attachment to life. You are right that there is nothing wrong with being born. If there were, why would Buddha and Jesus be born? It is indeed a blessing. Buddha's comments were taken literally, and he was not unhappy with this rendering, since it helped communicate the truth he was trying to get across.
But if birth and rebirth really just mean attachment to life, then the whole idea of giving up attachment in order to prevent rebirth no longer makes sense.
No, the chain of causation is still a logical pyramid. Buddha was correct. This literalism has done little or no harm.
Oh, I see. One does not so much eliminate birth and death as transcend them.
Yes.
I was told to quiet myself and become receptive. I felt God merging into me, then me into God, and was told not to think, but just linger there without thinking. It was like the Brahman, or God beyond God, perhaps. It didn't feel personal, but not impersonal either, and it seemed to have a magnetic pull as an object of desire. It felt encompassing, not just of me, but of everything. Not like a matrix, but like a nest or envelope, perhaps something similar to the void of Buddhists. I thought I heard a yes, but then not quite that. A place that offered rest and integrity in the literal sense of having one's disparate aspects settle into a coherent unity.
Buddha went directly to the heart of the spiritual life. He understood that it is a life of personal fulfillment, bliss, that overflows to others. Notice the extent to which love runs through so much of my revelation to humankind. Without love, the normative is useless. No one always does right. We are all in need of grace, which is to say, love.
Release from this travail of woes requires spiritual enlightenment, so Buddhism teaches. Transcending all desires and beliefs takes many lifetimes. Only then does one enter nirvana, the blessed void in which the chains of birth and rebirth are broken. Avalokiteshvara achieved the ultimate goal. He was a Buddhist saint, or bodhisattva, a Buddha in becoming. He was ready for nirvana, but hearing the sounds of a suffering world, he returned to the world and will return again and again until every last person has been released. Lord, with the ideal of the bodhisattva, were you trying to communicate something special?
Yes, I love every individual infinitely. That unbounded love that popular religion often attributes to God is exactly right. It is like a mother for a child. It is not enough that I relate one-on-one to individuals. That is truncated. Human beings need not just individual friends, but families, social groups, and communities. You relate to individual friends in the context of these social groups, not just with them in the background, but they help define and produce the concepts and values reflected in the particular friendship. In the Buddhist mode, this is reflected in the sacrificial life of the bodhisattva. It is obviously relevant to Jesus as well. Love for me, love for one's wife, family, friends, love for humankind, love for nature, love for being are all intimately related to one another.
The bodhisattva's vow is sometimes described as world redemptive. What does that mean, Lord?
Not like the Jewish repairing the world, as in the Kabbalistic text, the Zohar, which is repairing an ontological rift, but more like saving everyone from a burning building, getting each person out of the illusions of Maya and into an enlightened state.
The Buddhist goal is nirvana, pure emptiness.
The doctrine of the void is without merit. Later elaborations of Buddhism that emphasize the illusory nature or non-reality of the world are metaphysical nonsense. They are not helpful, they are harmful. The world is quite real, even though it is not the most important thing. And there is more to it, certainly, than natural science or common sense reveals.
According to Heinrich Zimmer, quote, the bodhisattva assumes the various forms in which he appears for the salvation of beings in the phenomenal realm. He assumes, for example, the divine forms of Vishnu for those who worship Vishnu, and of Shiva for those who worship Shiva. End quote. Buddha is called the compassionate one, But you have said that Jesus is the essence of love.
Compassion is not the same thing as love. Don't rush to boil everything down to a single principle. Love is important, but so is compassion. No human being loves everyone, but can feel compassion, fellow feeling, with all human suffering.
You have put Jesus at the top. He is the only one who is the ontological essence of love, love that continues today and is available to everyone who, as they say, believes in him.
Yes, he has that special niche, but that is not to say that his role is more important than the other religions. You relate to me personally and see the other revelations as glosses on that experience. But they could just as well see your relation to a personal God as a gloss on Brahman or Buddha or the Tao.
Let's see if I understand that. The Hindu could say the Brahman is the fundamental reality and God is a manifestation of that divine reality. They already have avatars, which would fit Jesus, and he could be a unique avatar. Buddha is not providing an inventory of the divine reality, and his message would stand regardless of whether there is a God. If there are gods, they too would need to become enlightened. The Taoist could say that one way to tune into the Tao is to hear it as the voice of a divine person, but it would be one who went with the flow, not much like the Old Testament God. We started with love, but I felt you wanted me to pray about the big picture.
You have been, but take a step back and look at it all, the whole story, my story.
One part of the big picture is the revelation of various aspects of your nature?
No, not that.
Oh, you mean your story, the story of your development?
Yes, that. What do you see?
I see a God emerging, struggling, ordering, interacting with nature, animals, people, revealing himself and aspects of divine reality to various peoples, each with their own particular concepts and types of receptivity.
And then?
You are suffering through it all, out of love, and moving everything forward toward some unspecified purpose. Is that the gist, Lord?
Back up again, step farther back. What do you see?
An emerging God who orders and guides the world and urges humans along as partners in that effort.
Now step really far back.
I see a God who goes from incarnation to incarnation, world to world, doing the same task or whatever in each to whatever end.
Look at that.
Thank you for listening to God and Autobiography, the podcast. The words of God are spoken by Jerry L. Martin, who heard the voice. He can be reached at godandautobiography.com. The narration and dialogue of Mr. Martin are spoken by Scott Langdon, who also edited, mixed, and engineered this episode. He can be reached at thescottlangdon.com. You can read the original true story in the book from which this podcast was adapted, God and Autobiography as Told to a Philosopher by Jerry L. Martin, available now at Amazon.com and always at godandautobiography.com. Pick up your own copy today.